More than 100,000 Americans died from drug overdoses over a one-year period starting in May of 2020. That's up 30% over the previous year. The recent rise of fentanyl is a big part of the story. Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid that's mixed into other drugs, making them more potent and deadly. Yesterday, the bipartisan Federal Commission on Combating Synthetic Opioid Trafficking put out a report with dozens of recommendations on how to deal with the problem. On the list of suggestions, more coordination of law enforcement and diplomatic efforts to curb the flow of fentanyl between countries. The commission also said reducing demand for drugs in the U.S. was a part of the answer and called for more investment and research into addiction treatment. We're talking now with a journalist who's been following this issue for years about the new challenges created by synthetic drugs, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Has drug use or drug overdose affected you or your loved ones? Do you worry about the danger posed by drugs containing fentanyl? What do you think can be done about it? If you work in addiction treatment or in law enforcement, have you seen things change in recent years? Call in with your questions, your stories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sam Quiñones is a journalist and author who's covered the drug trade for years. His books include Dreamland, The True Tale of America's Opiate Epidemic, and his latest, The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. Sam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's great to be here with you, Rob. Thanks very much.
We hear a lot about the dangers of fentanyl. Can you remind us what fentanyl is and why it is so hazardous?
Well, actually, fentanyl is a magnificent drug when used medically. Mm-hmm. It has revolutionized surgery. It has made surgery possible, but before it was not, or much more difficult, would have been much more difficult. It's a synthetic opioid invented in 1960. And one of the reasons, there's a couple of reasons why it became such a good anesthetic and did so much, had so much benefit in the surgical context. One of them is it's extraordinarily potent. But it's short lasting. It comes in and out very, very quickly. And so I've had fentanyl myself when I had a cardiac surgery after a heart attack. I'm very happy that I did, because you come out very quickly and you're not doped up for, you know, hours and hours after its use. You can be actually almost coherent. I was when they were putting a stent in me. And so the problem is that when this drug, which is an extraordinarily potent opioid, is then in the hands of people who don't have a clue how to use it, or only are interested in the profit, because it's also an opioid. So it has the same addictive potential, actually even more enhanced addictive potential as heroin. It hits the same parts of our brain, the reward system in our brain, as heroin does, and it creates massive withdrawals just the way heroin does. And so it's a drug that's been widely used in medicine, and in the last few years become widely used primarily because of its down in Mexico. They have learned how to make it, and they have access to the world chemical markets through several ports, and that allows them to make fentanyl in quantities that are simply staggering and have really covered the country with it.
And you've looked at the changing supply chain. We use this phrase supply chain for legal products. It has changed a lot for the production of fentanyl, from being produced entirely in China to, as you say, precursor chemicals. Can you talk about the changing flow of these products?
Sure. At first, the place where it was really coming from was China, in fact. The chemical companies, thousands of chemical companies over there, they began selling it on the dark web, or also sometimes on the open internet. Some of the clients for that fentanyl were the traffickers in Mexico. In my book, The Least of Us, I tell the story of how the Mexican trafficking world discovered fentanyl through an underground chemist who later was then arrested, and they didn't really have access to him. So several years passed, but they never forgot that there was this synthetic heroin that could be produced in a lab instead of growing poppies. The Chinese began to produce it, but then in a few years ago, the Chinese government put a regulation on the number of companies that could actually produce fentanyl, and that meant that they did not control the ingredients that go into how you make fentanyl, and those companies that were selling fentanyl are now making the ingredients, selling that, and now what's happened in Mexico is the trafficking world down there has really learned how to make fentanyl and probably a few other chemical cousins, analogs of fentanyl as well. And they're getting those ingredients now from the Chinese chemical companies that many of which I believe once made fentanyl itself.
Talking to Sam Quiñones, author of books including The Least of Us, True Tales of America, and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth, looking at the hazards of the drug fentanyl when used and produced illegally. You can join in with your thoughts, your stories at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Chandra is with us in Ironwood, Michigan. Chandra, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
I'm a recovering addict. I was prescribed OxyContin at a real young age, precursors to addiction, became addicted for about 16 years plus, really struggled with finding resources for addiction and also struggling with chronic pain. I have chronic pain from a birth defect in the spine. And so once that was taken away from me, I needed alternative solutions, but I also needed solutions for recovery so that I didn't fall back into synthetic opioids or prescription medication abuse. One of the things that I found that has been profound for me has been kratom. It's a plant from Southeast Asia. It's an evergreen. The leaves itself are ground up into a powder, and it interacts with opioid receptors in a much safer manner and also has an activity ceiling. So therefore, you don't get suppressed breathing or heart rate to the point where overdose is imminent. So my two cents is, looking into these botanical drugs, regulating them more appropriately, and creating safe access points where people have alternatives to, opioid treatment that may not necessarily be synthetic opioids.
Chandra, thanks a lot for the call. I know kratom is controversial to say the least, Sam, but on the treatment side of things, that's part of this report we're talking about. Do you have thoughts on kratom, first of all, and then on wider issues of helping people like Chandra, and glad you're in recovery, Chandra, stay in recovery?
Yes, I mean, I think we do need to think of a variety of things that were kind of sidelined when we had this very laser focus on using opioid painkillers as the solution to pain. I think in the pain management world, the idea had been and now is returning to credence that we need to have a variety of treatment options for chronic pain. The problem was really we tried to do cure all pain with one kind of pill for all kinds of human beings, and that just didn't work really. And the idea being that now I think that, as I said, was very popular during the 70s and 80s and just got aced out by the opioid issue, is that we now need a wide variety of reimbursable treatment solutions that doctors can then meet and act as kind of a teammate with the patient on and adjust according to that individual's need. And that is what we've really been lacking, I think, when we're getting off the topic of synthetic drugs, I think, but that's really what's been lacking, I think, generally speaking, across the country when it comes to just managing chronic pain, is the idea that all human beings are different and they need a wide variety of options to deal with each individual case of pain.
Chandra, thanks again for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. That's a little bit about the treatment and the demand side, Sam. Let's get into recommendations from this report on enforcement to try to stop the flow of these synthetic drugs into the U.S., diplomatic efforts. It seems like there's a lot of whack-a-mole. Once you fix things in one spot, the supply chain changes, the route changes.
Well, yes, but I mean, The big issue we're dealing with is the problem of Mexico. Mexico has a criminal justice system that on a good day is mediocre. I would say I lived down there for 10 years. I wrote two books about Mexico. And you get this feeling that really nothing's being done. Actually, I would say that there's more likelihood of a significant impact now, because unlike the days when they were making mostly plant-based drugs, marijuana, poppies, which you can grow all over Mexico. Mexico's a vast country with very mountainous areas. the crux here is that these traffickers now need chemicals coming from the entire world chemical market through a few ports. Those ports are their bottlenecks. If we actually put significant resources combined as binational effort into controlling, examining, understanding the flow of those chemicals and blocking the chemicals that did not have a real good reason for being there, and controlling those chemicals into the port, you would immediately see a significant drop off. Would that production go somewhere else to another country? Maybe, but the reason we have so much methamphetamine and fentanyl, both synthetic drugs, all over the country, covering the country at prices that are historically low, is because in Mexico, they have this amazing capacity to get the chemicals, make the drugs, and then smuggle it across the 2,000-mile border with which we with the United States, where there's also a free trade agreement. So it might push it elsewhere, but I think that the quantities that we're seeing today, which are just staggering coast to coast, would significantly be impacted if we paid attention to those ports and in a binational way really address the enormous flow of chemicals that are coming through there, because that's really the Achilles heel of the trafficking world today.
We're talking to Sam Quinones right now, journalist and author of several books on the opioid epidemic and the drug trade. His latest, The Least of Us, True Tales of America and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. We're looking at drugs like fentanyl, how they're raising the risks after a federal commission's report yesterday on how to try to curb the trafficking of these synthetic opioid drugs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has drug use or maybe a drug overdose impacted your life or that of a loved one? What do you want to see done to try to prevent addictions and deaths stemming from these more potent drugs containing fentanyl? What questions do you have for our guest? And if you work in the field, in addiction treatment, say, or law enforcement, what are you seeing where you are? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with journalist and author Sam Quinones, whose books include The Least of Us, True Tales of America, and Hope in the Time of Fentanyl and Meth. We're looking at the problems that synthetic drugs create and what can be done about it. You could join in with your questions, maybe your stories, at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Rick is with us in Neenah. Rick, hi.
Hello. About 20 years ago, I lost my sister. She was a heroin addict. And died from that. And I've looked at all of the things that have happened to her and have happened since, and it occurs to me that our best bet is to not try to stop it, is just to legalize it and then put into place controls, right? And the controls in the United States would also translate to controls elsewhere, which would have a gigantic impact on the crime, not only here in the United States, but worldwide, and would allow us to have funding to go ahead and treat opiate addiction as a public health crisis rather than as a criminal activity.
Rick, thanks for the call. Sorry for the loss of your sister. Sam, what do you think?
I don't know. I mean, we don't seem to be doing a very good job with marijuana. I go back and forth on this topic almost every day, maybe every hour, frankly. You know, we are dealing, though, with fentanyl here. The idea that people would make fentanyl legal for use, I just can't see how that would work. Honestly, it is too deadly. Now, heroin's another issue. On the other hand, I think I would like to see marijuana done well, and I don't think we're doing that well at all. You know, there's no attempt to put in strict controls on potency. There's no attempt to really inspect if it's a consumable, inspect it as a food or a consumable liquid would be inspected. If it's a medicine, inspect it the way a drug would be inspected. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that we need. And until we do something right with a drug like marijuana, I doubt our capacity to do that on a level with something like heroin. I also think that I just doubt our ability as Americans to do it. Other countries might be able to do it in a better way, but it seems to me that we just have this laissez-faire idea that when it comes to drugs is really going to be dangerous. We have this also this natural tendency, it seems to me, in this country to get out of the way of large concentrations of power and money and influence. And we see this in big pharma, big oil, you name it, big this, big that. And I think we need to put in place controls that would prevent big pot, let alone big fentanyl someday, you know.
Rick, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Sam, something you cover in your book, The Least of Us, we have actually a frequent public health guest here on the show, Dr. Patrick Remington, who writes about diseases of despair, which includes suicides, alcohol-related deaths, and drug overdose and drug-related deaths. You are looking at not just, you know, this individual demand, but kind of as a social problem, creating despair and a demand for these drugs. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think one of the things that struck me without me actually looking for it, but just couldn't avoid it early on in my first book, Dreamland, on this topic, was the idea that at root here was what we as a culture, as a country, have kind of inflicted on ourselves, which is this kind of generalized shredding of what brings us together, generalized shredding of community in many, many ways, you know. Could be jobs going overseas and the community that's left behind is left to fend for itself. But it also could be, you know, municipal planning and a suburban development and all these different ways in which we have decided that the urge for community doesn't, we don't need to follow it, or that doesn't, old rules don't apply to us. When in fact, the idea behind community is one of the most powerful things, probably the most powerful idea that we evolved to prize, because it kept us alive. It allowed us to survive. It's this idea that we don't survive without others. And that's what allowed us as a species to survive. It's very clear to me. It's just that in the last 40 years in the United States, we seem to have decided that we don't need that kind of stuff. We don't want to pay taxes for it. We don't want to support it. If the jobs leave one community, well, that community is kind of on its own and deal with it, you know. And it just seems you could go on and on and on about the ways in which we have stripped and shredded the pillars and the bulwarks that keep us together as a community. And it was very difficult for me to avoid that conclusion as I was writing about first the opioid epidemic and now this synthetic drug era, which is the subject of the second book, The Least of Us. But the reason I called it the book The Least of Us, it's a book about synthetic drugs, but it's the heart and soul of the book is about people who understand the importance of community and in small ways are working in the smallest, least sexy ways are working to repair community, knowing that they are not saving the world in some noble, virtuous sense, knowing they're not necessarily going to be applauded or anything. It's just daily showing up to work at repairing and making their areas, their towns, their streets, whatever it happens to be, a better place. So my book is really about synthetic drugs, but the core of it, the heart and soul of it, is the idea that we possess within us as human beings, having evolved for the last millions of years, this essential nature, that's the most potent force more potent than drugs, it seems to me, except that in the United States, at least, we've decided that it's not that important that we could do without it.
I want to hear more about the hope side of your book, The Least of Us, Sam. Can you share an example of the kind of work you see people doing that is hopefully going to help rebuild that fabric and then help deal with problems like opioids?
Well, there are many stories, and it's not just dealing with opioids and addiction I wanted to focus on. I was really focused on something broader. And so I'll tell you the story of Bird, a guy named Bird in the south, a neighborhood in South Muncie, Indiana. It used to be a town that was devoted to producing transmission capital of America, two enormous plants right in that neighborhood where he lived. And those plants began to wither away, and the jobs left, and finally they closed. The city decides, you know what, we have to do something. We don't have any budget to keep us going. So they decide we're going to close the community centers in each of the neighborhoods where we have them. One of them is right across from the street from Bird's house where he's grown up. He's worked there at that community center. And so the city leaders close the community center, they think, except that Bird keeps the key, right? And so what ends up happening as the jobs are finally gone and as the opioid epidemic begins to really take a toll, Bird becomes a community center unto himself. He daily opens it for the kids to play basketball and for the older folks to play cards. And when there's a wedding or when there's a birthday, he is the community center, keeping it alive when the city leaders really thought it was closed. They didn't really know that he was opening it all the time. They certainly put no budget into it. He's the one fixing the toilets, the one mowing the lawns. And he, for several years that way, he keeps that neighborhood, gives that neighborhood a center through which it can weather some of the most stressful economic and drug-induced problems that they've ever had. It's that kind of story that I wanted to tell. Nobody has ever told Bird's story. I just kind of stumbled on it myself, and it was an exhilarating moment when I did. But the idea was not so much to deal with addiction, per se, but to deal with the idea of how do we do things to keep ourselves in community and connected to one another, even when there doesn't seem to be any way to do it. I mean, the easiest thing for him to do is throw up his hands and say, oh, well, what are we going to do? Instead, he says, you know what? Folks need this. This is a way that we can weather some very tough times. Don't know how long it'll last. And he just goes ahead and every day opens that center for the kids and for the folks who need to use it.
And Sam, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure.
That's Sam Quiñones, journalist, author of books about the opioid epidemic, including Dreamland and his latest, The Least of Us. He joined us to talk about the rise of fentanyl in the drug market and a variety of solutions on the table. Find a link to a new report on the issue at WPR.org/Central Time. If you or someone you know is dealing with substance use or addiction, the Department of Health and Human Service National Helpline is 800-662-HELP.